You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you updated on the news that made headlines around our state this past week. Our panel today, Heath Druzan with Boise State Public Radio News, Rebecca Boone with the Associated Press, and Don Day with BoiseDev.com. Happy Friday.
Hello.
Hello.
Okay, Rebecca, we have to start with the case of the two missing siblings over in eastern Idaho, J.J. Valo and who's 7 years old, his 17-year-old sister, Tylee. They have not been seen since September.
Right, late September. So about, what does that make it, 5 months or so?
About 5 months.
Yeah. So, and of course, extended family is incredibly concerned, as our police, Rexburg Police, said in December that they were gravely concerned. They strongly believe that Joshua and Tylee's lives are in danger. Joshua is his given name. He goes by JJ. And it's just been, I mean, it's been something that people have been fearful and worried about for months mm-hmm. now. And JJ and Tylee's mom left town the day after police questioned her, you know, right before Thanksgiving last year, said, "Where are the kids?" And she apparently, they say, told them that they were staying with friends or relatives in Arizona. They went and checked. That wasn't the case. Came back the next day. And Lori Valo and her new husband, Chad Daybell, were gone. They'd left town. So there's been a lot of people wondering where these kids are and a lot of people wondering where Lori Valo and Chad Daybell went. Earlier this week, the public found out they were in Hawaii. They were on Kauai. Apparently, they've been there for some time. Police from Rexburg traveled over there, worked with police in Kauai, served them with an order, Lori particularly with an order that says, "Hey, produce your kids by Thursday at 5 p.m.
In Idaho.
In Idaho. In Rexburg. Or face the consequences of the court," right? So that means that maybe she could be held in contempt of court. Maybe a judge could issue an order to have her extradited to face a contempt charge here. I mean, we don't really know what happens at that point. Well, deadline came and went. They did not show up. So kids are still missing. Investigators still don't know where they are. Extended family still doesn't know where these kids are. And Lori Valo and Chad Daybell did not come to Idaho, so they very well could still be in Hawaii.
So we spoke with Nate Eaton with East Idaho News.
Shout out to them.
Honestly.
Idaho News. They deserve a lot of credit.
They really do. I mean, Nate has been following this case from the beginning, and the reporting there, honestly, has been top-notch. In fact, I mean, so they went, Nate and a photographer went to Kauai, and were there on Sunday when Chad and Lori were pulled over, when they confiscated the vehicles. Talked to the prosecutor in Kauai County. Prosecutor saying there's never been any sighting of the children in Hawaii.
Right.
And I believe I just read this morning, Nate posted another story that they do know that Chad and Lori are still in Kauai, but there's nothing, but they have not been arrested, but potentially could be, because this was a court order that she did not follow through with.
Right. And let me just say this. There is a ton. This is a very tangled case, and there is so much detail. And if listeners want to know more, I can say they EastIdahoNews.com. They have timelines. They have such an extensive depth of reporting that would be a good place to go to find out more. So with that being said, yeah, it's a child protection case at this point, right? And those are typically sealed in Idaho, which means the prosecutor in Idaho, Madison County prosecutor, had to get special permission from a judge just to be able to say that they'd issued this child protection order directing Lori Valo to come with the kids to Idaho before 5 p.m. on Thursday. So we don't know if we're going to know what happens next, because these cases are typically sealed. So unless the judge decides there's a compelling reason for the public to know the next step, it'll remain sealed most likely.
And the authorities in Kauai have actually been very open. Last night on KTVB, Shira Matsukawa was saying that the Kauai Police Department told her, she called them and they said, "Yeah, you know what, we'll take action in this case if we hear from Rexburg, and we're waiting on that." So that was last night at 6 o'clock, so a bit ago. But it's been interesting to see how this process has played out with some authorities that have been a little bit more open than they would otherwise be on this case.
Well, and don't you think, though, it goes back to, as you said, Rebecca, this is a layered case, because this is only one piece of the puzzle in this case.
Right.
Because Chad Daybell's wife, Tammy, died in October. That death is now being looked at as suspicious because Lori and Chad were married shortly after Tammy died. But then Lori's ex-husband was killed in a shootout by her brother, and now her brother has also died.
So there are three separate death investigations going on at this point in at least two different jurisdictions, right? So Lori's previous husband, they were estranged at the time. He had filed for divorce, and he'd actually requested a protection order saying, I am frightened of this woman. I'm worried she's going to harm me. Was shot and killed by Lori's brother, Alex Cox, in July. At the time, Alex Cox said, you know, it was in self-defense. Police documents indicated that Charles Vallow had a bat and may have used the bat to strike Alex Cox. So I think initially they kind of chalked it up to self-defense. But now they're, of course, looking back into that. Well, in December, Alex Cox died of what is currently unknown causes. And so police also in Phoenix. So police in the Phoenix area have, you know, taken the remains for an autopsy and toxicology reports. And as of earlier this week, at least those results were not yet available. They were not back yet. So they were still waiting on those results.
And we should say, I mean, no, truly no disrespect, because there are two children that are missing. But this honestly sounds unbelievable. I mean, this seems like a soap opera.
Sounds like House of Cards.
I mean, honestly. And
it's kind of like light, a true crime mystery, except as of right now, I don't think there's been any criminal charges.
No criminal charges against. They are persons.
Not at this point.
Chad and Lori, correct, Rebecca, are persons of interest in the case of the missing children, but that's it.
That's all that authorities have said at this point. Yes, that they're people, persons of interest.
And as you said, we may not know what happens next in this.
We may not. You know, I mean, there's been a lot of, we see a lot of things on Twitter and in social media and stuff. I'm like, well, why didn't they intervene sooner? Why didn't they? You know, these kids have been missing for so long. I have a feeling that's an answer that we will find out eventually. Mm-hmm. Generally, investigators on missing kids cases like this have a pretty extensive game plan. We don't know what that game plan is. But, you know, JJ's grandparents, Kay and Larry Woodcock, have said that they are completely confident that the police here, the police elsewhere, the FBI are doing everything they can to find those kids and to bring those kids home.
Let's switch gears here because there is other news that has been going on this week. Dawn, this came out about 2 days ago. Update us on a possible legal filing that's in the works. This is related to a petition that Boise voters approved in November regarding the stadium.
Yeah, so former Boise City Council member Scott Ludwig tells Boise Dev that he intends to file a writ of mandamus with the Idaho Supreme Court, challenging the legality of some of the language in the petition that voters overwhelmingly passed on the stadium. Now, as I've said on this program many times, and it's always very confusing, that vote was to set up a vote for a vote on a stadium project. There was also another project in the library, but this particular thing doesn't involve that. Scott essentially says that the wording in the petition infringes on private property rights because it says what you can do with your private property. Now, Boise Working Together, which put that petition together, pushed back pretty hard basically just said Scott was foolish and that he was wrong. Scott says he respects the intent of the voters, but he also thinks that private property rights need to be protected. He hasn't filed it yet as of yesterday. We're going to see where this goes. Boise Mayor Lauren McClain was asked about this on Wednesday of this week, and she made it pretty clear she's not interested in a stadium in Boise. The $3 million that had been earmarked under the prior Beter administration, she wants to go towards affordable housing in the city. She thinks that's the big priority right now. The stadium developers will not talk to me. I've asked multiple times through intermediaries directly, probably 30 times, honestly, over the last year, and they won't chat with me. So I don't know what they're thinking. I do know that they tried to get on a citizens advisory committee at Expo Idaho. People may know that property and its future is being reevaluated by Ada County. Ada County has been clear that this will be a very public process, and it was. I went to the meeting on Wednesday this week. Sorry, I've got a head cold, so keeping track of dates is really difficult. And it's been a busy news week. So it's going to play out in public. Stadium developers weren't there, but Bill Connors, who is the president and CEO of the Boise Metro Chamber, was. He is clearly advocating on behalf of the Hawks. He's been a longtime proponent of minor league baseball, even before the current stadium developers came to town. There's a lot more to play here. A lot of reporters have questions, and we'd like to kind of know what's going on. But right now, the stadium developers are silent. I also reported this week that they sold – or that they're hoping to sell the land under the Symposium Bar that they bought near a proposed site downtown. It's the That's the third site that they've tried to build on, first on Broadway, then on Americana, then in the west side. All three of those fell apart. I would say it's highly unlikely that they will ever be able to build a stadium in Boise for a number of reasons. So where do they go? Expo Idaho, Meridian? I don't know. Greater Boise Auditorium District also at play here. There's a lot to this. BoiseDev.com. I've got a long story on all the elements, and we'll keep following this.
Again, it is so complicated.
It is very complicated, and I'm sorry if I made it seem more complicated.
No, you did not. You did not. Heath, you were recently in Las Vegas, not for fun, for work.
Right.
And so tell us why you were down there, because the governor was there as well.
Yeah, that's right. So I was at something called SHOT Show, which people in the kind of gun world probably know, and people outside of it probably have no idea what I'm talking about. It stands for Shooting, Hunting, Outdoor Trade Show. And it's basically the biggest gun industry event of the year anywhere. There were 60,000 people was the estimate who came there. And we're talking about everyone from you know, like the gun barn in Name Your Town in Pennsylvania, to actual officials from foreign militaries looking to buy, like put in huge
orders. Did you say foreign militaries?
That's correct. Okay. That's correct. I saw people from as far away as Turkmenistan. It's a wild show. And you've got everything from hunting knives to military grade weapons. A lot of law enforcement there looking to buy for their agencies. So it's a mix. It's all the kind of new technology and like what's kind of hot in the market there. And it's a week long event. The governor was there, and it was not his first time actually. And his predecessor Butch Otter had also attended. And it's interesting because what they're very open about is that they go there to recruit the gun industry to come to Idaho. So they tout our kind of gun-friendly laws, our gun-friendly culture, and they're trying to get companies to either move to Idaho, which has happened in the last few years, or to open up additional manufacturing, which has also happened.
Really? So what kinds of – when you talk about outside of gun manufacturing, like what – would these be just like a gun store moving in here? I mean, what are – when you say like trying to promote businesses to come here?
No. Well, I mean – I'm sure they welcome that too, but this is kind of on a bigger level and a bigger scale. So I'll give you an example. Caracal is a company with offices around the world, including in Abu Dhabi, and they make military grade weapons on a pretty large scale. They outfit foreign militaries. They opened Caracal USA just a few years ago. And that is their North American hub. And they were looking around. Idaho wasn't even on their radar. I spoke to their CEO, and he was saying, yeah, it wasn't on our radar. And then Butch Otter talked to us, told us how great Idaho is. They ended up looking at Boise and actually moved their North American manufacturing here. So that's the kind of thing I'm talking about.
Wow.
And they're a multinational company.
Rebecca, you wrote a story earlier about the state of Idaho could possibly save money by building a new prison?
Well, that's what the Office of Performance Evaluation says. Now, the Office of Performance Evaluations is sort of like the state auditing system, right? They go in, the legislature asks them to research, do these really deep dives on certain things, and they go and they dig up all the information, they analyze it, they just really look at things from every angle, and then they present these reports. So they were assigned to look at correctional capacity in Idaho, which – if you've ever heard the words prison overcrowding, you know it's a pretty big deal. Idaho has been dealing with prison overcrowding for years. As a matter of fact, there's decades-long lawsuit going back to like 1980, talking about prison overcrowding in the state. So this is a constant problem. And as our population has been growing, so has our inmate population. But actually, it's outpacing the state population dramatically. So the state population since 2016, OP says it's grown by about 6%, while the inmate population has grown by about 18%. So we're looking at a huge jump. Right now, we are shipping inmates out of state. We are housing them in county jails, which is making a lot of county sheriffs and county governments really upset because they are running out of their out of room and it costs them money. And the Department of Correction has kind of floated this idea, like played around with the idea of building prisons in the past. But we haven't built a new facility for quite a while, right? We've got ICC, which was built, what, a little over a decade ago, I think, maybe more than that now. And the CAP facility is still fairly new in the scheme of things, like, you know, not 50 years old.
Right.
Like some of our other prisons are.
Right, yeah.
But OPE says basically, like, when you look at the money we're paying to house inmates out of state, and we also have to fly contract monitors out there regularly to make sure that they're not, you know, in terrible conditions at these privately run prisons. And when they're in county jails, we have to pay for that. Plus, they aren't getting the programming and stuff that they need to get out of prison to qualify for parole. So then, you know, that can potentially lengthen their prison term, which also costs us money. They said basically you can save money if you build a new prison. You can save millions of dollars. So building a new prison would cost something along the lines of, I think, $78 per inmate per day, which is a savings of about $4 per inmate per day compared to sending them out of state. It's a savings of about $17 per inmate per day when you look at the total cost of housing them in county jails, which includes them missing, of course, out on some educational and rehabilitative programs. So they said, you know, if you want to save money,
build a prison.
You should consider this among your options, which is building a prison.
And where are, so that is just their recommendation.
Right. They said what they need is a minimum security prison for women and one for men. Right now we have, I think, to the tune of something like 1,000 inmates that are minimum security that are actually housed in a more expensive medium security prison because we just don't have enough minimum security beds. So that also costs the state money.
Heath, you did a story recently on CDC mortality rates. Can you talk about that, but also how this reflects on Idaho, but our suicide rates?
Yeah, we got an early look at the CDC's annual mortality report, and it is exactly what it sounds like. It's basically it's a very comprehensive report on the causes of death in America. And so these are the numbers for 2018. They tend to lag about a year behind. And it showed basically gun deaths in this country staying about steady. And they had set a record in 2017, and it was almost exactly the same number, almost 40,000 gun deaths. Now, that includes homicides, suicides, accidents. It's every gun death in America. So that's a very high rate for a wealthy country like ours. There's not really any other wealthy country that comes close. And we don't have the state by state numbers yet, but Idaho's numbers are actually out. And it's kind of bad news for us too. We have a very high suicide rate. Yeah. We have for a long time. And certainly there's some government action kind of getting in the works now to try to find solutions. But our rate is it went up. The way they do it is per 100,000. So it's about 23.8 per 100,000, whereas the national rate is just a little bit over 14. So it's a huge difference.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. We have one of the worst suicide rates in the country.
And it's young people too, isn't it? I mean,
The rate for young people went up a lot. The rate for older folks went up a lot too.
Okay.
It's certainly something that affects all demographics, but yes, the elderly and folks, I believe 24 and younger, their rates went up especially high. So that's something that certainly people I've been talking to in Department of Health and Welfare. And at the suicide prevention line, you know, they're really trying to find some solutions because it's becoming a real crisis here.
Right. Don, this came out yesterday afternoon. For people who've been around Boise for a while, there used to be the Blues Bouquet, this bar, and their bands would come in and all of that. Mm-hmm. That closed down a while ago.
A long way.
So this building, what, around 10th and Main Street, right, in Boise, has kind of sat empty.
Yeah, so the best way to describe it is it's got a big sign on the side, one of those aging oil signs that says Hotel Manitou. And that was kind of one of the first tenants. It was built in the early 20th century, about 1901, I believe. And it's kind of got a colorful history. It was known to, I think one of the descriptions said, host colorful ladies upstairs.
That's one way to put it.
The description I read. It had a movie theater in it.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that when you wrote that.
Somebody told me after I published the story that it had an archery range in the basement. So this is at 1010 Main, used to host the Blues Bouquet. After that, for a very short time, it was the Ice Bouquet. And it's been closed since about 2013. A Boise kid is maybe the best way to put it, by the name of Cal Elliott. He left Boise right after high school and went on to become frankly, a renowned chef in New York City. Worked at was the chef at a restaurant that won a Michelin star, and he has operated a couple of operations in New York City. You know, usually when I Google somebody for a story, I might get like an old Boise Weekly story, or you Google him, you get New York Times, you get Vice, you get Eater.
I mean, he's legit.
He's legit. And I first talked to him in 2016. So he's been working on this project for a while, has owned the building for a long time. He wants to revitalize it. What he wants to do on the first floor is put in two restaurants and a hotel lobby. So if you put a hotel lobby on the first floor, that means on the next three floors, he wants to put hotel rooms.
Put an archery in the back of the basement?
Yeah. I don't know about that. But he really wants to pay attention to the history of the building. There is an old Brunswick bar that has kind of moved around town a few times but landed in that building in the 70s. It's also about 100 years old. Anybody who's been in there remembers it.
Yeah, but it came to Boise, what, in like the 30s or something like that?
Old medicine again. I don't remember the exact date. But yeah. So a lot of people have been through this building over the years. It was a bar for decades. The upper floors, the hotel, that was abandoned in the 1960s. And even if you look at the exterior of the building today, the windows are shot out, mm-hmm. and there's graffiti on the building. He's been quietly at work for several years cleaning the building out, and there's been some permits to that. But now we're to the stage where he submitted design review, and we'll go through some of that. He wants to take it to Federal Historic Register standards. It's not on that register, at least as far as I could tell, and it's also not an historic district for Boise, somewhat surprisingly. But he really wants to do something that honors the legacy of this building. Pretty cool to see somebody from Boise go away and come back and bring those new skills back to town. I'm going to have more on this early next week. I've got a story up now that talks about this, but I'm going to have a little more detail early next week.
I thought that was interesting, too, when I read your article. When he's very adamant about really the historical preservation of this. And he said, that doesn't mean that it might be like – it's not going to be like the fanciest hotel, but it is – going to have this historical significance. And he said Boise needs that.
Yeah. And Boise has seen a boom in hotel rooms, and there's actually several other people who want to do boutique hotels in the downtown area. I think this will fill a very specific niche if he's able to put together. 39 rooms isn't a ton. I've not been up there. I have been up there, but it's been a long time.
I didn't even know that was existed.
Yeah, my dad actually used to work at the Bouquet once upon a time, so we went up and watched fireworks on the roof. And I remember going through the stairs and being like, this place is a dump. Holy cow. And so he had told me that he's cleaned most of that out, and I can vouch that that is quite a task.
Oh, I bet.
So this is going to be something to watch, and yes, we're still a little ways from this happening. But, boy, I posted this. Yesterday was a big news day for Boise Dev, and I posted this, and it just went crazy. Mm. Newcomers and people who've been around alike, I think, are really excited to see some revitalization on Main Street in Boise.
It'll be exciting to see that. I mean, but he sounds incredibly committed to making this happen.
Yeah, he does. And I think that's really neat. And the founder of Vanishing Boise commented in my Facebook group and said how excited she was. And I said, it's almost like reappearing Boise.
Right.
Bringing something back that has been a part of Boise's lore that went away.
So is he officially back in Boise yet? Because, I mean, he had a restaurant in New York City, right? But shuttered that in order to do all
That's a great question. So I actually only talked to him for about 4 minutes yesterday, and he said all the stuff you reported before was true. And I was like, okay, well, that's good.
Thanks for that.
And then
we had a brief conversation. So some of those things. He did close down the restaurant in New York City about this time last year and has been grinding away on this project.
All right. So we'll see more next week.
More on Boise Dev next week. Yeah.
All right. We have got to wrap this part of the show up. Our panel today for our roundtable, Don Day with BoiseDev.com, Rebecca Boone with the Associated Press, and Heath Drusen with Boise State Public Radio News. Always a pleasure to have you guys in.
Thanks, Gemma.
This is Idaho Matters.